which would have its premiere at the Queen's Hall in London a year later. More of that tomorrow, plus from the final years of his life, the evocative symphonic poem The Noonday Witch and part of his best-known opera, Rusalka.
And Donald MacLeod is back with Composer of the Week tomorrow evening at its regular time of 6:30.
On BBC Radio 4, Mark Mardell explores the relationship between the world's two greatest powers.
The American eagle and the Chinese dragon are now intertwined, so I've come here to find out what the Chinese are making of the relationship that will redefine a world.
America is a country our China should learn from.
China and America, harmony and hostility.
China is becoming stronger and stronger, and then we'll be the number one in the world, and then America cannot ever try to bully us.
On BBC Radio 4, on Tuesday night at 8.
This is BBC Radio 3. Good evening from me, John Shea. It's 7 o'clock now. Time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. It's presented by Penny Gore.
Welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where tonight two of this season's main themes meet, courtesy of a visiting ensemble, the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano Giuseppe Verdi, making its proms debut. And on the bill is, of course, music by Verdi.
I like to call Giuseppe Verdi the father of opera. He was an amazing icon, amazing composer, and when we talk about the Verdian line, is this flowing of music from one note to another, from one bar to another, which really is unique.
The tenor Joseph Kalea, who will join the orchestra, and its Chinese-American music director, Xian Zhang, for Verdi arias in part one. And in part two, the orchestra will be rounding off 2013's Tchaikovsky Symphony Cycle with a performance of the Manfred Symphony, the composer's mightiest orchestral work, and the symphony he considered, for a while anyway, to be his best. But first, a Verdi overture, The Force of Destiny, a heady tale of love and revenge, set in 18th century Spain and Italy. It was first performed in Russia, perhaps a little surprisingly, in St. Petersburg in 1862. It had been commissioned the previous year by the city's Imperial Theatre. But this now celebrated overture only appeared for the revised opera's first performance at La Scala Milan, 7 years after its premiere. And as you can hear, the orchestra tuning up, they were joined by their leader, Luca Santaniello. All the players come on stage at the beginning, stand to face the audience, and when they're all assembled, they take their seats ready for the start of the concert. And they're joined now by their music director, Xian Zhang, to begin this evening with a performance of Verdi's overture, The Force of Destiny.
Thank you.
The overture to Verdi's The Force of Destiny, opening the Verdi 200 celebrations in the first part of this concert. Performed by Prom's debut ensemble, the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano, Giuseppe Verdi, or La Verdi as it's called for short, under its music director since 2009, Xian Zhang. Well, the tenor, Joseph Calea, is about to join the orchestra on stage now for the first of his arias, taking us from one of Verdi's most famous pieces to some that are perhaps less often staged, but certainly no less dramatic. Attila was premiered almost 20 years earlier than The Force of Destiny. It's the story of the 5th century king of the Huns, and O Dolore was written for the opera's first performance at La Scala, so it wasn't in the original score. And as we'll hear throughout the first half of the prom, adding arias like this was something Verdi very often did as his ideas changed and developed. He had a bit of a habit of returning to pieces once the first performance had taken place. Well, applause now for our soloist this evening, the tenor Joseph Calea. I think his fan club's in here tonight with Xian Zhang for this aria by Verdi from Attila, O Dolore. O Dolore from Attila, sung by Joseph Calea in the tenor role of Foresto, lover of the beautiful Odabella, who's been taken prisoner by Attila's forces. And he'll return with an aria from the Sicilian Vespers, sparked off by the 12th century rebellion on the island of Sicily against the occupying forces of the French ruler Charles I. Verdi wrote a tenor role in that, the Sicilian rebel Henri, and we'll hear A Toi que j'ai chéri. It's another of those later editions I mentioned, written for a revival of the piece in 1863. Henri's third act lament from the Sicilian Vespers, sung by Joseph Calea with the orchestra La Verdi, conducted by Xian Zhang. And Joseph Calea will be back after another masterly overture, the prelude to the first act of La Traviata, expertly setting the scene for the action to follow.
Thank you.
the prelude to the first act of Verdi's La Traviata. Now, Simone Boccanegra was first performed 4 years after the premiere of La Traviata, and it had one of Verdi's most convoluted plots. That didn't go unnoticed by the critics. But in 1881, he revised it with a different librettist, and we'll hear Joseph Calea in a spectacular aria from the second act.
Lover!
Joseph Calea singing O Inferno from Verdi's Simon Boccanegra. And there'll be more to come from Joseph Calea after we hear one of the most spectacular orchestral showpieces in Verdi's entire and considerable output. It's from Aida. Celebrated triumphal march from Act 2 of Aida with four offstage trumpets. Xian Zhang conducting the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano Giuseppe Verdi. Well, Verdi's 15th opera, Luisa Miller, was inspired by the works of the German dramatist Schiller. It's about a village girl who falls in love with a young man, Carlo. He turns out to be the highborn Rodolfo. And Joseph Calea is going to return now to portray one of Verdi's most vividly drawn tenor roles.
Se mortali d'angeli attestarmi volesser ella non è rea. Mentite, io risponder dovrei. Tutti mentite. Son cifre sue. Tanta perfidia, un'alma si nera, si mendace. Bella troppo il padre. Ma dunque giuri le speranze, le lacrime, la gioia, l'affanno. Tutto è menzogna. Tradi me.
She betrayed me, then I, silent, ecstatic, would hang on to her words when she, in angelic tones, said, I love only you. Joseph Calea as the tormented Rodolfo in Verdi's Luisa Miller. With the orchestra La Verdi from Milan making its first appearance here at the Proms and its first London appearance too. With conductor Xian Zhang, and music director since 2009, and incidentally, the only woman conductor of a major Italian orchestra. Well, I have little doubt that Joseph Kalea will be returning. He's a great Verdi interpreter. After his appearance at the last night of the Proms in 2012, he's a big favourite here too. He'll be at the Proms in the Park this year. And here he is, back on stage to join the orchestra. La Donna Immobile, the licentious Duke of Mantua in Rigoletto, with pretty much his philosophy in life. Woman is wayward as a feather in the breeze, capricious in word and in thought. He who trusts her or confides in her is always wretched. Joseph Kalea singing one of his signature roles. He sung the Duke of Mantua in Munich. And here he is tonight with the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano, Giuseppe Verdi, and music director Xian Zhang, and Joseph Kalea bowing as the members of the orchestra rise, Xian Zhang beaming on the podium, and she has a great operatic background as well, started her career as a pianist in fact, playing for opera singers and got drawn into conducting along the way. And she makes her way off stage with Joseph Kalea. He was inspired as a teenager to go into singing by hearing Mario Lanza, and particularly by seeing Lanza's film, The Great Caruso. And in fact, Joseph Kalea's following rather in Lanza's footsteps. He'll be acting the role of Caruso in a forthcoming film. And he's back on stage now. People around me in the hall standing. So we've got a bit of an ovation going on for Joseph Kalea. And he would like the conductor to come back. Xian Zhang rejoining him on stage and asking members of the orchestra to take a bow, members of the woodwind section. The horns and now all of the strings as well. Xian Zhang grew up in China and has studied in America. Lauren Mazel was one of her great mentors. Carla Maria Giulini, she was saying earlier, is also one of her heroes. And she lives, obviously, in Milan now, where she works with this orchestra, lives there with her young family. And the orchestra is having a very special season at the moment. It's 20th anniversary, all sorts of celebrations going on. This concert, of course, being a part of it. And, well, you can hear from that stamping and cheering. Joseph Kalea back on stage now. And Xian Zhang applauding him as he comes to the front of the stage. And I think a Maltese flag being flown in the audience here. Joseph Kalea hails from there, goes back often, and is one of its most famous sons. In fact, he was there not long ago to give a celebration concert. Pretty much everybody who was anybody was there. And this orchestra here has a very high proportion of young players, as I say. It's been going for 20 years now. Some of them have been there from the start. All very excited to be here at the Proms. And they're all standing now. They play in a very splendid converted cinema in Milan, the Auditorium, which was specially converted for them as a new concert hall. And the orchestra is very keen on education. It runs a program with schools growing up in music, going into schools to run music classes and putting on concerts for young people, right from nursery school level and upwards. And the members of the orchestra taking their seats again. And a bit more stamping going on in the hall here. I don't really need to say anything. Well, all that's going on. You can hear how enthusiastic the Proms audience is here tonight. But as I said, it's another chance to enjoy Joseph Kalea's singing. This year at the Proms in the Park, when he returns in the wake of his appearance at the last night of the Proms last year. You may remember him sporting a particularly fine tracksuit on that occasion. Will he be lured back? Well, yes, here he comes. He was saying earlier that it's particularly special for him to perform here at the Royal Albert Hall. And he's only sorry that his late father couldn't be here to see the occasion. It would have given him such a thrill. And he turns to audience and orchestra, blows kisses. He's a multi-award-winning artist too. His international career was launched when he won the Hans Gabor Belvedere singing competition. And Milan has played a very important part in his career too. He won the Caruso competition there in 1998. And he's something of a protege for Placido Domingo as well, of whom he speaks very fondly. Well, Joseph Kalea makes his way off stage now, and from Verdi, the orchestra will turn its attention in 20 minutes or so to Tchaikovsky. That's in the second half of the concert. Xian Zhang conducts the Manfred Symphony to conclude this season's complete Tchaikovsky symphony cycle. But we're staying with Verdi for a little longer in tonight's Proms Plus intro, which took place earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music, just across the road from the Royal Albert Hall. It's introduced by Ian Skelly.
Now, there's been much talk at the Proms this season about Wagner and the way of telling a story with the orchestra. Wagner famously saw the orchestra as the chorus in a Greek tragedy, with all the characters effectively depicted within the orchestration using his famous weave of leitmotifs. But what of his exact contemporary, the man whose music we're enjoying tonight at the BBC Proms, Giuseppe Verdi? Is it all about the voice with Verdi, or can we learn a thing or two if we take a closer look at the way he employed the orchestra? Just as with Wagner, Verdi had a great influence over the development of the orchestra, something that Tchaikovsky was to benefit from, especially when he came to his great brooding Manfred Symphony. Or did such developments enable the cult of the romantic hero to find its true voice? To unpack all of that is Claire Holden, who's a member of the Orchestra of the Age of Enlightenment. She regularly plays with plenty of other early music groups and is someone who is passionate about the history of performance practice. She's a research fellow at Cardiff University, specialising in early 19th century string playing. And alongside her, Professor Jonathan Bate, Provost of Worcester College, Oxford, writer, playwright, broadcaster, a leading expert on the entire Romantic movement, and a fan of Verdi too?
Oh, definitely a fan of Verdi, especially, of course, his Shakespearean operas. But yeah, I mean, the thing about Verdi is that he is central to the Romantic movement, that although you think of Romanticism more with Wagner, the Germans, Northern Europe, but one of the key aspects of the Romantic movement was the way in which, in the 19th century, literature, music, and painting were used by creative artists who were involved in a process of shaping a sense of national identity. Sir Walter Scott, the great novelist of Scottish identity, was hugely influential. Verdi absolutely loved Scott. And of course, across Europe, there were many operas based on Scott. So that aspect of Verdi that is to do with the sense of an Italian national consciousness and national identity, his involvement with the Risorgimento, the union of Italy, all that's very much at the core of Romanticism.
We'll come back to all of that, but let's just start with the orchestra and with Claire. Give us a picture, if you would, of what the orchestra was like then when Verdi started out and how it then developed.
Well, much smaller than it was towards the end of his life. During Verdi's career, the orchestra in La Scala almost doubled in size. One of the very noticeable things when Verdi started writing was Italian orchestras had very, very few cellos compared to what we're used to today. You'd quite often find orchestras that had more than twice as many double basses as cellos. Some orchestras might only have two cellos. I think La Scala had four cellos and eight basses at the beginning. And Verdi is very interested in the development of the orchestra. He's very full of ideas and influences from travels abroad on how Italian orchestras can be improved and enlarged. There's quite a lot of letters go backward and forward between Verdi and Ricordi, his publisher, saying, I couldn't conceive of letting the new opera be performed at such a theatre because those viola players were absolutely shocking last time. Or, yes, okay, they can have the opera, but they must get more cellos in to boost the section. And the other thing that's worth remembering about most of Verdi's career is that there wouldn't have been an interpretive conductor in the way that we're so used to today. The first conducting without a violin bow being in use didn't happen in Italy till 1860, so really quite late.
Was Verdi very interested in using the orchestra to move the drama on, or was he more interested in the voice doing that?
No, I think really, I mean, we know of Verdi being this hugely important dramatist, but actually one of the things that is really key in that is the function of the orchestra. By the end of Verdi's career, he's really using the instruments in a way that they're almost like an extra character. What the instruments do is tell us more about the emotional states of the characters than the singers themselves can. So you'll hear things in the instrumentation. You know, it might be a sob, it might be a sigh. And this becomes more and more as his style develops and you go through the second, third periods. And by the time you get to Otello and then to Falstaff, you really see that this is, a real expert.
So let's leap forward then to the very end of his career, to 1893, to his last opera, Falstaff. You've got an example here where there's so much of that coming to maturity, lots of wit as well within the orchestra. Could you just talk us through what we're going to hear?
The bit we're going to hear, Falstaff has just been bragging to Ford that he's got an... He doesn't know that Ford is Ford. He's just been bragging that he's got an assignation to seduce Mrs. Ford that afternoon. So Ford's pretending to be someone else. He has to be all nice to Falstaff. Falstaff leaves the stage, and at this point, Ford gets into a rage of anger, which turns into self-pity. And just at the moment, he's feeling most sorry for himself, and he's indulging in all this personal angst. We get these horns, which are like straight from Mahler, and it's really tappy. It's just poking very gentle fun at the whole kind of angst-ridden self-obsession of the kind of North German, North European German kind of music of that time. So.
Master Ford, Master Ford, pardon me. Stai su, ti presto, tua moglie sparta, e metti in palazzo, l'onor tuo, la tua casa, e il tuo.
Marvellous stuff. The OAE, as you say, has been playing Verdi all summer. What does it reveal about Verdi when you're playing with authentic instruments? Is it easier to get the balance, actually, with authentic instruments?
Absolutely, actually. I mean, the gut strings sort of have a different sound about them, which makes it much easier for the singers to penetrate over the top without forcing. You've got narrow bored wind and brass instruments, which make a different sound. And Verdi was very specific about the sound he wanted. It's very clear. One of his pet hates was tubas. Really didn't like them. Mainly because he thought they didn't blend, but he's also slightly biased against conical brass instruments anyway, because they seem to be coming from the German-Austrian musical tradition, which goes back to all these ideas of the Risorgimento and that actually they want something to break away from this kind of oppression that they've associated with Austrian invasion and things like that. So he's very specific about that. So one of the delightful things when you do it on period instruments is that you get this wonderful looking thing called a cimbasso, which is what Verdi intended it to be performed on. And it's sort of, it's like a hybrid. It works a bit more like an ophicleide than a tuba, but it's kind of like a super basso trombone that's kind of turned on its side, and it makes a really extraordinary and wonderful noise. So the colours, I think, is the main thing about
it. And Verdi did, of course, write a couple of operas that were somewhat Byronic, weren't they, Jonathan?
Well, not just somewhat Byronic, they were dramatisations of narrative poems by Lord Byron. Well, in one case a narrative poem, in another a play. The Corsair was a tremendously popular poem of Byron's. It actually sold 20,000 copies on the day it was published. It was the best-selling poem in history when it came out. It has a pirate and a lover. Verdi turned that into an opera. And then Byron also wrote a number of plays, which were quite successful on stage at Drury Lane. One of them, The Two Foscari, about rival doges in Renaissance Venice. And that's another one that Verdi turned to an opera.
Just link us, if you would, Lord Byron, with Romanticism, because one's sort of got both of them in one's head at the same time. I'm not quite sure which comes first, chicken or egg.
Well, Romanticism comes first, and Lord Byron is the apogee of it. Byron said, poetry is the lava of the imagination. And that's kind of as good a definition of Romanticism as you get. Romanticism, a movement partly stimulated by the French Revolution, a revolutionary movement across all the arts, literature, theatre, music, painting, really takes off in the late 18th century, initially in Germany and Britain, and then expands across Europe, in which creative art becomes about self-expression, an explosion of the imagination. Artists are interested in passion, in their feelings, they're going back to nature, whereas so much 18th century art is very, very civic, very much of the community and the city, very harmonious, symmetrical. All that's thrown away. It's back to nature, back to the feelings, back to the self. One of Byron's contemporaries said he was the first artist in history to make himself the subject of everything that he wrote. And so whenever one has an image of a 19th century creative artist, you know, passionately alone in their garret, I mean, Hector Berlioz's memoirs, I think, are one of the great texts that give you an idea of what the romantic artist is like. The artist is compelled to write. It's as if he's taken over, he or indeed sometimes she, is taken over by a sort of demonic spirit, and there's that great volcanic explosion of imagination.
So therefore, do we read Manfred for Byron? Because it was written after a particularly eruptive episode in his life.
We do indeed, yeah. Manfred is a key work in Byron's life and career. So just to explain the origins of this, in 1816, Byron's short-lived marriage to Annabella Milbank collapses. There's a very strong rumour, which is almost certainly true, that the reason the marriage has collapsed is because he's been having an affair with his half-sister, Augusta. She did actually go with them on their honeymoon. It was the greatest scandal in Regency London, and Byron was effectively drummed out of the country. He goes into exile. He actually goes to the shores of Lake Geneva, and it's then that he famously meets up with the Shelleys, and you have the night when they tell ghost stories and Mary Shelley writes Frankenstein. Whether or not you take the autobiographical line, there's no doubt that Manfred, alone in the mountains, passionate, communing with nature, tortured, melancholic, he is the archetypal romantic figure, and everybody identified him with Byron. He doesn't want forgiveness, he wants forgetfulness. Interestingly, at the end of the poem, he's not forgiven, but he ends up committing suicide. When we come to Tchaikovsky's symphony, in terms of the program of the symphony, there's a quite significant change in that the figure of the spirit or ghost of Astarte, his lost love, does pardon him and forgive him. The ending is rather softened.
And, of course, I would imagine, heavy in his mind are other composers who have taken this theme as well, not least Berlioz. We've got a little excerpt from Berlioz's Harold in Italy. Perhaps you could just talk us into that and what the significance was at the time of this piece.
Yeah, this I mean, Berlioz, I think, is the key figure for explaining the origins of Tchaikovsky's Manfred. Berlioz, you know, the most literary of all the great romantic composers, obsessed with Shakespeare, but also with Byron. And he wrote Harold in Italy, which is based on Byron's poem, Childe Harold's Pilgrimage. That was the poem Byron said, I awoke and found myself famous. It was the poem that made him into the European celebrity he became. A great piece of program music, like, you know, opera without voices, tells the story of the poem.
Let's just hear Berlioz to begin, and then we can come on to the Tchaikovsky.
Thank you.
Berlioz conducted that in Russia late in his life in the late 1560s. And everybody in Russian musical society got really excited about this idea of a Byronic piece of program music. And that then led a critic of the time to suggest to a Russian composer called Balakirev, who was a friend of Tchaikovsky's, that he should write a Manfred symphony sort of in the style of Berlioz's Harold in Italy. He didn't do it. They actually asked Berlioz if he'd like to do it himself. He said he was too old. Many years passed, and eventually Balakirev kind of gave the idea to Tchaikovsky, and that's how it originated. Eventually, when he did do it, he absolutely threw himself into it and felt that it was one of his greatest achievements. I think one of the things that made him hesitate was the fact that Schumann had been there before. In the 1840s, Schumann wrote an overture and incidental music for a staged production of Manfred, though, as I say, Byron wrote it for what he called a theatre of the imagination. It was staged in Germany in the 1840s with wonderful music by Schumann. There's a fantastic story of someone in the audience who later wrote a memoir of Schumann saying that when Schumann was conducting the overture of Manfred, before the very eyes of the audience, Schumann became Manfred. That idea of the artist becoming this tortured character, Manfred. Tchaikovsky, at some level, because his own feelings, his own sort of tortured life, bore up upon him. Perhaps he was almost afraid of becoming Manfred himself. He was going to go into a very dark place.
It's very interesting because he did regard it as one of his best works. Then he actually threatened to destroy it because he started to hate it. And it has had, Claire, a somewhat checkered history in its performance. I think it was Toscanini who thought it was the greatest piece that Tchaikovsky had ever written. Bernstein called it trash. What's wrong with it? I mean, what's your feeling as a player? What's difficult about it that makes it so rarely performed?
Well, it is difficult, is one of the main things. It's much more technically challenging than any of the symphonic writing that he'd come up with before then. It's also, you know, it's big. It's quite an undertaking. You've got the best part of an hour, sometimes, you know, depending who's conducting it, can tip over the hour mark, and the four movement form of it is a kind of very important component of what Tchaikovsky was doing, but somehow structurally he didn't quite nail it. Particularly in the later movements, it's so free, the structure and inventive, that actually somehow it just doesn't quite sit satisfactorily to some people. I got to say, I'd put myself in that camp.
I think you're right. I think it does go awry in the second half, as it were. But I think the first two movements are wonderful. I mean, I think the thing to hold in your mind's eye in the first movement is the figure of Manfred alone in the mountains. You know that wonderful Caspar David Friedrich yes. picture of the wanderer high on the mountaintop? That's the image to hold in your mind's eye as you hear the first movement. And then the second movement is beautifully light. It's Manfred's dialogue with a spirit of, I was going to say a rainbow, but actually Byron's word in the poem is a sunbow. That's to say there's a waterfall with a reflection coming from the sun above it. And it's beautifully light. And I think those first two movements are fantastic. But I do agree with Claire, there is a bit of a problem with the last movement.
Claire Holden, Jonathan Bate, thank you both very much indeed.
That was an edited version of the Proms Plus event held earlier this evening at the Royal College of Music. It was introduced by Ian Skelly and produced by Helen Garrison. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Penny Gore, live on BBC Radio 3 and online in high-definition sound. Well, after the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano Giuseppe Verdi's tribute to their namesake in the first half of the concert, they turn, as we've heard, to another composer we've been focusing on throughout this prom season. 2013's Tchaikovsky Symphony Cycle reaches its towering finale with Manfred, based on an epic poem by Lord Byron. Conductor Xian Zhang is definitely one of the work's champions.
About this piece, there's a lot of controversy. Some people hate it. Some conductors, like Bernstein, he didn't like it. Conductors like Toscanini loved it, but he did huge revisions. He did huge cuts. Its length is very long. With program music, that itself, as a fact, is already very difficult to manage. Rather than a long symphony, the music has to go according to the story or to the poem, to whatever it's written for. So for that, it's difficult. But the music itself is lyrical, dramatic. I think it's a beautiful work.
Xian Zhang. Well, as we heard in the interval, the idea for setting Byron's poem came from Balakirev, mentor to so many young Russian composers in the 19th century. But Tchaikovsky took a while to come round to the idea of writing this symphony. He eventually agreed, though, and started work in the spring of 1885. He quickly became enthusiastic. He told a friend he was captivated. I cannot remember ever having felt such pleasure in working. And the result, this four-movement piece for huge orchestra, tracing the protagonist's anguished wanderings through the Alps as he mourns the death of his beloved. And here to conduct Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony is Xian Zhang, music director of the orchestra La Verdi.
Thank you.
Tchaikovsky's Manfred, the culmination of the Brahms Tchaikovsky symphony cycle. A work that left the composer hopelessly conflicted. At first he was declaring it my best symphonic work. Later it became an abominable piece. And opinion about it, it's fair to say, has ranged between those points ever since. Although Xian Zhang is not one of the doubters. Conducting the Orchestra Sinfonica di Milano Giuseppe Verdi with great energy, commitment and delicacy. And she's back on stage now. Born in China, started out as a pianist and attended the Central Conservatory of Music in Beijing. And she really got her big conducting break thanks to one of life's flukes. Her teacher sprang a surprise on her by saying she'd be conducting a major Mozart rehearsal the very next day at Beijing's Central Opera House. And that really was what set her on the path to becoming a conductor. And she's working her way around the orchestra now, asking the woodwind to stand, the percussion, and all the strings now. This is an orchestra that's made many recordings, including a complete Shostakovich symphony cycle and a multi-award-winning disc of Verdi heroines with Angela Gheorghiu. And as for tonight's performance, and indeed all the Tchaikovsky symphonies in the season, you can hear them online at the BBC Proms website. And Xian Zhang coming back on stage and taking her place at the podium.
Thank you.
An Italian encore, of course, from this Italian orchestra, from Rossini's William Tell. Qian Zhang conducting the orchestra La Verdi, an ensemble with an enviably diverse repertoire all the way from Baroque to contemporary music. And of course, as we've heard tonight, a special affinity with Italian opera. And members of the orchestra turning to face the choir stalls flanking the organ here in the Royal Albert Hall to make sure that all the members of the audience get to see them and that they acknowledge the applause. Well, tomorrow night here at the Royal Albert Hall, the Vienna Philharmonic will be here, conducted by Qian Zhang's mentor, Lauren Mazel, in Bach and Bruckner. That's live at 7:30. But we do have another prom to come tonight, if this applause ever ends. So for now, it's goodbye from the Royal Albert Hall and back to the Radio 3 studio to join John Shea.
Thank you very much, Penny. That was Penny Gore presenting tonight's first prom, which, as ever, you'll be able to listen to again for the next 7 days online. In fact, Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony is due to be available via the prom's website for up to 30 days. That's along with some of the other Tchaikovsky symphonies from this BBC prom season. Well, another prom later tonight, as Penny just mentioned. We're back at the Royal Albert Hall for something a little more intimate at 10:15 in an hour's time. Some late-night Schubert at the piano, or pianos rather, Imogen Cooper and Paul Lewis. And that's our late prom this evening at 10:15. Now Donald MacLeod looks ahead to next week.
It takes a lot to get the Usher Hall audience on its feet, but the Chamber Orchestra of Europe raised the roof with their adrenaline-fueled performance of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. You can hear that, the second of a pair of concerts they gave at this year's Edinburgh International Festival. On Monday, the Orchestra of Virtuosi in Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, Strauss's Metamorphosen, and Haydn's Joyful Sinfonia Concertante. And on Tuesday, the orchestra delves further into the richly contrasting worlds of Strauss and Beethoven with that Seventh Symphony that got them a standing ovation. The Chamber Orchestra of Europe from Edinburgh on Monday night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
Well, in case the sound of the organ towards the end of Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony just now has whetted your appetite to hear more of the instrument, there is indeed organ music in the first half of tomorrow night's prom, as Penny Gore just mentioned. Setting the scene for Bruckner's Eighth Symphony in the second half, the organist Klaus Sonnleitner will be playing the Royal Albert Hall organ and music by one of Bruckner's idols, Johann Sebastian Bach. That's at 7:30 tomorrow evening. And not to be left out, in the afternoon, another chance to hear last Sunday night's prom by the Orchestre de Paris, which ended with Saint-Saëns' organ symphony, and that's from 2:00 tomorrow afternoon. Back to this evening on BBC Radio 3. Our next programme in just under a quarter of an hour is tonight's feature. And this evening, another chance to hear a programme from earlier in the year, A Cultural History of Weeping. That's at 9:30. It's followed by our late-night Schubert prom at 10:15. And then Nick Luscombe is here at 11:45 with Thursday's edition of Late Junction. So before the feature, let's return to the spirit of the first half of tonight's prom, the music of Verdi. And in case you're a little surprised to have heard one of the shorter performances of the Triumphal March from Aida, let's make amends now with a generous helping of Aida as transcribed for the piano by Liszt. This is his arrangement of the Sacred Dance from Act 1 of Aida and then the final duet from Act 4. Liszt's transcription is played here by Daniel Barenboim.
Thank you.
I forgot to tell you before we heard that was that was a live concert recording, Daniel Barenboim at La Scala Milan in May 2007, and he was playing Liszt's transcription of Verdi's Aida, the sacred dance from the end of Act 1, and Radames and Aida's duet from Act 4. In a couple of minutes, our feature, then at 10.15, Late Night Schubert from the Proms, and Late Junction at 11.45. To whet your appetite for the Schubert, here's one of his part songs. If you've ever wondered what the missing link was between Schubert and the West End hit One Man, Two Governors, and which of us hasn't, there it was. Words by Carlo Goldoni, Il La Pastorella, set to music by Schubert and sung there by the Utrecht vocal soloists with Ronald Brautigam at the piano. And as I mentioned, there's Late Night Schubert from the Proms at 10.15. This is BBC Radio 3. It's now 9:30. And time for this evening's feature. Thomas Dixon is a historian of emotions, and in this programme, first broadcast on Radio 3 in January, he explores the rich cultural history of weeping in Margaret, Are You Grieving?
You weep for various reasons, don't you? I think I've wept in mourning, but also in anger. But the real area that gets me in weeping is if I feel I've been done wrong to.
Music is the thing that makes me cry, though I think I always stop myself. I weep at anything these days, particularly since I became a father. It makes me self-conscious, and then I think I become not exactly embarrassed, but I question my own authenticity, I suppose.
I cry too much. I mean, so my own particular problem would be the sort of self-indulgence of tears rather than the absence of them.
It's a bit like vomiting. I mean, it's certainly cleansing, and you do feel the unsayable is coming out.
I myself am not someone who readily breaks into weeping, but that doesn't mean that I haven't deep experiences of, certainly, of aesthetic forms.
I cry in all children's films. I cried at Toy Story 3. I cried absolutely anything, really. The Archers makes me cry. It's interesting because I think, in certain lots of ways, my measure of an artistic experience is whether it makes me cry, and music makes me cry more easily. But when I've been to the theatre and it's made me cry, I've thought, oh, well, that must be good.
Mm-hmm.
Mozart's Requiem was his final work. The manuscript was unfinished when he died, breaking off after 9 bars of the Lacrimosa, the section describing the Day of Tears when all humanity would be judged. According to one account, in the final hours of his life, confined to his bed, Mozart sang through his Requiem with friends. When he reached the Lacrimosa, he set the manuscript aside, weeping bitterly. Mozart's short life spanned an era now famous for its extravagant emotional sensibility, the second half of the 18th century. But throughout our cultural history, tears have been intimately connected with the arts, whether as inspiration or response. The classicist Simon Goldhill.
Perhaps the most outstanding example of classical weeping from the earlier period is Homer's Odysseus. And when Odysseus hears the story of the sack of Troy, in which he himself had took part in the palace of Alcinous, he breaks down into tears. And that prompts his host to say, please tell me your story. So tears become a response to art in the earliest epic, and also the prompt to art in the earliest epic.
Gerard Manley Hopkins' poem, Spring and Fall, is addressed to a young child.
Margaret, are you grieving over Golden Grove unleaving? Leaves like the things of man, you with your fresh thoughts care for, can you? Ah, as the heart grows older, it will come to such sights colder by and by, nor spare a sigh, though worlds of wanwood leafmeal lie. And yet you will weep and know why.
I know when I am going to cry. There are signs. The shiver up the side, a particular sort of lurching in the stomach, the pricking behind the eyes. If it happens in public, I have a chance to gird myself. And there are some novels, pieces of music and films which I know will have this effect on me, whatever I do. A Tale of Two Cities, Tristan and Isolde, Brief Encounter. As part of a course I teach on Oscar Wilde, I show my students Brian Gilbert's 1997 film starring Stephen Fry. It always makes me cry. So I make sure that I sit at the back. Wilde is usually remembered as an anti-sentimentalist. He mocked those who wept over Dickens, saying that one must have a heart of stone to read The Death of Little Nell without laughing. But nothing is more guaranteed to make me cry than reading aloud from Wilde's own children's stories.
High above the city, on a tall column, stood the statue of the Happy Prince. He was gilded all over with thin leaves of fine gold. For eyes, he had 2 bright sapphires, and a large red ruby glowed on his sword hilt.
Wilde himself had tears in his eyes when he read these stories to his 2 little boys, explaining, one of them recalled, that really beautiful things always made him cry.
So he plucked out the prince's other eye and darted down with it. He swooped past the match girl and slipped the jewel into the palm of her hand. What a lovely bit of glass, cried the little girl, and she ran home laughing. Then the swallow came back to the prince. You are blind now, he said. So I will stay with you always. No, little swallow, said the poor prince, you must go away to Egypt. I will stay with you always, said the swallow, and he slept at the prince's feet.
Is it beauty that makes us cry? Why then do we feel ashamed of our tears? The shiver, the lurch, the pricking behind the eyes are bodily signs of complex thoughts. That's why, for some, tears have been a prized response to nature, relationships, art, and the divine. A response revealing elevated powers of thought and great aesthetic virtuosity. Unlike me, the historian of aesthetics, Pete de Boller, is not a man prone to weeping. But he too recognises the bodily force with which one can be affected by art.
There are a couple of experiences which, for me, are close to what I think for others may be what happens when they burst into tears or they weep. So the first is actually at a Rothko exhibition. And the first time I walked into the room, I felt as if I'd been hit by a hurricane or hit by some kind of force of nature. It was like wind being taken out of my lungs, as if suddenly I'd come up against something, maybe almost like a kind of pressure wave, something like that. And I began to tremble.
According to the art historian James Elkins, Mark Rothko has a unique place amongst 20th century painters in his ability through his work to make people cry. Rothko himself commented on this. In an interview in 1957, he said, "People who weep before my pictures are having the same religious experience I had when I painted them." I went to Tate Modern in London to look at some of Mark Rothko's paintings and to examine that idea. I took with me the Reverend Dr. Giles Fraser. So, Giles, before we go in, what's your response to that idea that people weeping over Rothko's pictures are having some kind of religious experience?
I'm suspicious of it, though I do also understand it. When I was an atheist, that seemed to be the nearest I could get to a religious experience. Sort of intense, passionate, emotional, but contentless. I used to walk past traditional places of worship and go and sit in the Rothko room, and that for me was a sort of spirituality without doctrine. Now, I think it's rubbish.
Well, let's go and see for ourselves. Writer John Banville has described entering this room as one of the strangest, most compelling, and entirely alarming experiences to be had in any gallery, anywhere. And as we come in, we see half a dozen of these vast red, black, purple, grey canvases in a dimly lit space, which have quite a powerful presence. So I should probably be quiet now, and we'll see what effect they have on Giles or on me. So, Giles, did you cry?
No.
I felt that I was being asked to do quite a lot of work, to be confronted with this vast space, suggestive of blood or of eternity or of the universe, but that I was having to bring a lot to generate an affective response.
I mean, you could say that's like prayer. So, I mean, you could say this is an empty space, and this empty space is the space that you're supposed to fill or that you confront yourself or God or whatever. So, you know, you're supposed to do a lot of work in prayer. So you could say that's exactly what's going on. My problem is that there's a terribly thin line between the sort of challenge that you might get in prayer and self-indulgence. And for me, I think they've just crossed the line into self-indulgence.
Tears, idle tears, I know not what they mean.
Psychologists haven't spent a lot of time trying to understand and explain adult crying.
Virginia Etuff is a psychologist at Birkbeck.
It's very clear why infants cry. It has a communicative function. They're connecting, reaching out to their caretakers for nurturing and protection and so on. But when we look at adult crying, it isn't enough to say, oh, we cry because we're hungry or we cry because we're cold, because it's more than that for grown-ups. The situations in which we cry have some meaning.
While poets have sung hymns to tears, and composers and painters have become experts in the art of producing them, scientists struggle to explain what's really going on when we cry. Emotional weeping seems to be uniquely human, but its evolution and physiology remain obscure. There is no grand theory of weeping.
One of the most influential theories of crying goes back to Aristotle, who proposed that we cry because it's cathartic in some way. And Freud picked up on that. But most recently, it's been researchers saying, well, it's cathartic because we feel better. And they've made the assumption that physiologically we would feel better, that it would lead to a lowering of arousal and so on. But actually, the evidence points against that. It's not a very successful explanation. I think for me, though, I have a tendency to think that we cry in response to some transformation in our sense of self, in our way of being, our orientation to the world.
We can trace our tears back across the face of history. The most read book in Western literature is also the great wellspring of Western tears. The Bible is a handbook of weeping, drenched in tears. Jesus laments tearfully over Jerusalem. Mary Magdalene washes Jesus' feet with her tears, and the Apostle Peter weeps bitterly after betraying his master. In medieval Europe, Christians were taught how to weep in imitation of these biblical figures. The historian, Miri Rubin.
So a whole tradition develops in Christianity of tears not just something that happens because, you know, you stub your toe, but rather something that's really quite special about your spiritual journey. What medieval people referred to as the gift of tears is something very particular. It's the chosenness of those who are striving for religious perfection. And then if they got it right, they would be blessed by the ability to cry, to express an inner self, and above all, to identify with Christ.
Among the religious weepers of the medieval period, one stands out, a middle-aged Norfolk wife and mother whose extraordinary autobiography was rediscovered in the 1930s and tells the story of a woman upstaged by her own tears.
Well, Margaret Kemp is an extraordinary English woman. She's born in 1373, or thereabouts. She's born to a really good family of merchants in King's Lynn. She was quite sophisticated without being educated.
One of the things that's very striking, both at the time and to modern readers, is the huge amount of weeping. Marjorie was blessed, as she saw it, by this gift of tears and sobbing. So why did she do all this crying?
She cried in many different contexts. She cried during sex with her husband, because after a point she didn't delight in it, as it were, as she comes to know her inner spiritual self, she takes less pleasure, and ultimately it's literally a trial, a tribulation. So she cries then. She cries when she's moved by the image of the crucifix. She cries when people do torment her, and they torment her. Clearly, it was more than just tears rolling down her cheeks. This was a performance. There's one very notable case where people look at her crying, and there's so much more happening. Like, she's falling to the ground, she looks weak. They actually think she has an illness, falling sickness, and obviously they're anxious, and they run away. They think it's catching. It looks like some malfunctioning of the body and the person. And that makes a lot of people uncomfortable.
The second